Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by Patrick Campbell. This is going to be a bit of an outside episode for us because it's something that's so important, so key to the sales process. But I don't know if Patrick, you would classify him as your traditional salesperson. Patrick, you're the co-founder CEO of what I used to call Price Intelligently. I'm now going to be responsible and remember that it's ProfitWell. Welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I think I do have some sales experience from back in the day and then moved quickly into sales ops, which then quickly went into pricing here. So at least I have some empathy for the sales brethren and sisterhood out there.
Very cool, man. So I think that the super interesting part of the process, or the reason why I wanted to get you on the show today, is because pricing is such a key part of the sales process. And it's something that us salespeople tend to be left out of. And it's something that you tend to be brought into that conversation with quite a few companies. Normally we don't do we get a final segment. You can, do a little pitch for ProfitWell. And we'll get to that right at the end, I promise. But do you want to give us just a little bit of your background before we jump in, just to provide some context as why this pricing consultant is now, if I can call you that.
No consulting. We don't do consulting. So okay. My background's in econometrics and math. Kind of more classically trained in statistics. And I worked at both the intelligence community in DC, as well as in at Google, basically doing econ modeling, which is kind of taking a bunch of, different data and trying to make something of it and trying to find value. And that kind of led me to pricing. We started off and we basically have some software that, and it is paired with service, but we essentially help understand willingness to pay as well as the relative value of features. And what we found, and the reason I got into this, was because pricing is one of the highest impact pieces of kind of growth. But as you kind of mentioned, not only in sales, but just in companies in general, not a lot of people really like think about it. And they know it's important, but they're not exact to do. And it's because it's, basically viewed as this monolithic thing that needs to get solved. And unfortunately, a lot of the reason, sales isn't brought into it is because the perception is that, a salesperson, won't ever want to raise a price, right? Because, that's gonna make not hit my quota, right? And in reality, like sales has a lot of power in the pricing process, not only from actively being on the front line, but also because like the greatest salespeople out there, they don't want to discount as much. They don't want to, not defend that price because that makes their quota easier when they don't have to do as much volume and things like that. So it's a little bit of background and a little bit of, again, empathy for my sales brothers and sisters out there.
Right on. And I'll throw in another sort of vote. We've been paying consistent attention to our pricing. And I think 5 years ago, we were $500 a month. And that selling what we do at that price nearly killed me. It was just me. It was, me, maybe an intern. And obviously that was the, all right, let's just see if we can get something started. Price. We've 10x that and more over the last 5 years. And every incremental step we've made has felt like a big, scary, terrifying piece. But when you look at, I ended up spending a lot of time on your blog, reading a bunch of your pricing teardowns, and I feel like I learned quite a bit, which was super helpful. And it gave me a bit more confidence to, talk to the team, to talk to customers, talk to competitors about, what they were pricing and sort of where, what that relative value was, and helped me realize that we were really undercharging for our services. And we slowly stepped it up. And every year we've got sort of a new iteration. And I got to say, the last iteration probably had an impact on the business in the realm of $500,000 to $700,000. So it's and that we made that change in September of last year, and so coming up on the 1 year mark, and it's been phenomenal. So we've got another adjustment coming up here that we feel is going to be a real strong win for our customers and the sort of long-term, sort of their long-term success. But it's, I wouldn't have gotten here without, you know, it wasn't just Price Intelligently or ProfitWell. It wasn't just your blog. I had, you know, other advisors like Stephen Forth and all these guys that sort of helped out and helped us sort of map out the journey and map out all the different sort of value. But that's the type of impact. And as a salesperson, that was the, it was one of the scariest things for me, is because, you know, just like you said, when the number goes up, the, you almost feel like, I'm going to sell more because, you know, I know a little bit about economics. The funny thing was, we raised prices 20%. Nobody batted an eye. We raised another piece, you know, 400%. And it, honestly, sales almost got easier. And I think we hit that point where, you know, it wasn't just you're not just a small startup. You're not just, you know, some fly by night, you know, company that's only been around for a couple of years. You're a real business. You're a premium product and you're charging like it. And that was a huge, that's had a huge impact on the business. So that's why Patrick's on the call or on the webinar today. We're going to hopefully impart some of that knowledge. We won't, might not go super deep into pricing theory, but that's what I'm hoping to learn or hoping to help everybody sort of get a handle on, because even if we as salespeople are not the ones that are making these price decisions, we are still involved in the pricing conversation, whether it's, it may not be at the strategic level, but it is at the execution level. And some of us, depending on, you know, the type of company that you work at, if it, you know, you might not be a SaaS company, you might be working for a company that, or even a SaaS company that sort of comes up with the price, you know, when the customer asks for it, you know, all the sort of custom prices that just sort of come out of nowhere. And I wish I knew all of this stuff 10 years ago. And had I probably would just be a really wealthy, you know, account executive just making a ton of money. And I wouldn't have to go through all the trouble of being an entrepreneur.
There you go. You and me both, man. You and me both. So,
I want to start by just, so that's the impact that pricing has had on us. I'm wondering if you could just share, you know, do you have some stories of the impact that that pricing's had on some of the companies that that you've either worked with or, you know, talked to or aware of?
Yeah, definitely. I think that to back up a second, so I had mentioned, you know, pricing is this really, really big growth lever. And what I want to kind of give is some good context to that and then fill in some anecdotes, because I think that's helpful. But from kind of an overall perspective, what we're seeing in the market, and this is just a function of the success of technology and software and marketing and sales, is that essentially there's more and more companies that are being produced. There's more and more products that are being produced. And that means you have more and more competition. And while that's happening, all of these companies and all of these products are basically filling different sales and marketing channels. And all of a sudden, no one has like a secret channel anymore. Or if they do, it's not very big. And we're not getting a new Facebook, a new Google every quarter like we were back in the day during kind of the gold rush. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is that basically, not only is our customer acquisition cost going up, but also the relative value of stuff is just going down. Because that Salesforce integration that you might have added as a $1,000 add-on per month, you know, maybe 5 years ago, now it's just, hey, you don't have a Salesforce integration, you're not going to close this deal. Like, you can't charge me for it. You just have to have it, right?
That's table stakes now.
Yeah. Exactly. And so because of this, acquisition is now becoming table stakes. And what I mean by that is you need to be good at sales and marketing just to survive. Like, that's just what we're seeing in the data. But when we look at basically isolating these three growth levers in your business, your acquisition, your monetization, and your retention, acquisition is trending towards zero in the sense of all around a 1% improvement in your leads or conversion volume, you're not getting that lot out. Now, pricing and your monetization and your retention is actually accelerating in its impact, because that's really where the growth is going to come from. And because of that, what's really fascinating is that really small, like 20% increases in prices that you mentioned, are actually starting to have like a much wider effect, not only on CAC, but also on, you know, your actual price and ultimately on your retention. So to give you a couple of anecdotes, you got to be careful with names, because most of our customers, they don't want to know that, you know, that we help, or we don't want you to know that we help them essentially in certain respects. But, you know, I can think of a company that was basically in the tax software space where they had a very similar experience that you were kind of talking about, where they actually had to double their price because they realized after, you know, kind of acquiring the same customer over and over again, that they basically were so underpriced, they ended up doubling it. And what was kind of amazing about it is they didn't see any increase in churn. No increase in churn. Everyone just kept paying. And they didn't even follow our advice in terms of kind of rolling it out slowly. They just kind of ripped the Band-Aid off and basically doubled the price and everything was fine.
That's quite a cowboy move for an accounting software company.
Yeah, it's very much like, hey, let's get it in the books right now. You know, kind of conversely though, we've seen some companies where they, you know, acquire all these customers and they realize that the customers they've acquired are just not good. Meaning their CAC is really high, the cost to serve them is really high. The value that they're getting is immense. And all of a sudden they're charging them something like $30 a month.
That was us in the early days.
Yeah.
But by the way,
you see that quite often.
CAC is cost to acquire a customer, just for any of the salespeople. Right? I've got that right, just for the
sales. Yeah. Customer acquisition cost. So basically a salesperson's salary, all of the money that's being spent on marketing, and then you kind of average that out across all of the customers that are being acquired. And it's an important metric, mainly because, you know, not all customers are equal from an ARPU, average revenue per user, or a lifetime value or LTV perspective. And this type of company that we saw, it was one of those things where, you know, they spent all of their time acquiring those customers and all of a sudden they were just like, we can't serve these folks because they're costing us more. And they had to do kind of a dramatic, you know, it wasn't even doubling. It was in some cases like 1,000x the price for these folks just to cover their costs. And the point I'm trying to make with some of these examples is that I think that what pricing really comes down to is really understanding your buyer persona. And a lot of us, instead of kind of taking a little bit of effort, kind of like what you're taught to do in, you know, college or high school or whatever, a little bit of effort to prepare, aka understand your buyer, do a little bit of research, we just kind of guess and check our way to success. And took a step back and just kind of understood the features or the aspects of the product that my customer cares about. What is the actual willingness to pay range, which, you know, we can get into a little bit of how to do that. All of a sudden, you would understand, hey, that buyer that you're going after now, that's the one you should have been going after 2 years ago. And there's a little bit of a chicken or the egg here because, you know, your product's improved in the past couple of years, but that's a really, really big thing to kind of keep in mind is understand those buyers because ultimately they're the ones who are purchasing your product.
100%. And I think the direction that sales has been going is sort of getting to that sort of sales process persona fit as well, right? So it only makes sense that that pricing would sort of follow. And we talked about this in the pre-interview. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what is persona pricing fit?
Yeah, persona pricing fit, like if you just think about your business, it doesn't matter what you're selling. You think about, you know, a SaaS product, you know, software. If you think about a cup of coffee or, you know, even like a giant tractor, right? Everything that you do in your business, your sales, your marketing, your finance, your product team, your, you know, even down sort of to the guy or gal sweeping the floors, everything that you're doing is either driving a customer to that point, or it's justifying the product or the price that you're offering. And what ends up happening is in the world of kind of converting a customer, you need to understand who's a good customer and who's a bad customer. So when you start to understand these things and you start to basically quantify that buyer, like I talked about a second ago, essentially what ends up happening is you align that entire funnel where that salesperson can come in and with a couple of discovery questions realize, oh, great, this is a Mitterprise Meredith or whatever cute name you want to give them. Mm-hmm. And he or she really cares about security and uptime. And also this is his or her price point. All of a sudden that sales conversation, that sales cycle becomes so much easier. And yeah, there's going to be exceptions. There's going to be a Meredith who doesn't really care about what other Merediths care about. But at least all of a sudden you have that fit. And if you do it correctly, then all of a sudden the machine starts working out really, really well. Percent of your what to do, either get rid of because they're not a target or, you know, close in a certain way. And then you can start to align your pricing, whether it's your tiers or the price that you're actually offering or the packaging or the features to each of those personas, which, you know, aligns them both for the acquisition of them, but also for their retention.
That's phenomenal. Because I think one thing that we're seeing more and more is, you know, as we talk about sort of aligning the sales process to the persona is this idea of battle cards. And, you know, companies are building them for sort of, here's your ideal customer profile, here's the people and the individuals within them. And there's a couple of different lenses that you can sort of look at the battle card through. And I think what you're proposing here is sort of adding a pricing element. And so what are some of the things that that you might add that a salesperson might want to have? What is some information that they might want to have coming into this conversation to understand where they're at on that?
From like yeah, definitely. Sorry, I was interrupting you there. I got excited to answer the question. So cool. I think that overall, it's a little bit more like what I would put on there if I was the sales manager. You know, I think because they're the sales manager, whomever's putting these together, you know, to close, team to close as much as possible. And so for me, I would put down things like, you know, discount controls. So understanding, hey, you don't need to give this person a discount. They never ask for one. They're not maybe a little like friends and family-ish kind of discount to get them over the line at the end of the month, but nothing intense. And here's where, you know, this person is basically going to come in from a price point perspective. And then anything related to their quota, basically like in sales incentive is probably one of the greatest levers in kind of an acquisition team. So anything that like, hey, this person has this much profit margin, typically this person has this much lifetime value, typically, or if it's just a straight number, hey, these are the people that you should go after. You should expect to close one or two of these a quarter, 10 of these a quarter, 25 of these guys a quarter. And then from there, then it's all about kind of the, you know, the things to hit on. And a lot of good salespeople just do this naturally, but for that enterprise customer, I want to put down, hey, talk about reliability, talk about that on the first call. When you present the budget, talk about this concept. These are the questions you need to ask about how do you actually make a purchase within this particular type of organization. And this might seem really simple to a lot of, you know, advanced sales folks, but that's literally all you have to do is just take what an advanced salesperson would do and just make sure that your, you know, less sophisticated or more junior sales folks are actually doing it. But to kind of round things out here, features that people care about, features that they don't care about, like don't talk about analytics to this persona. They don't care about that. Or, you know, talk about it if they ask about it, essentially. But yeah, that's kind of how I would focus. That's how I would think about this, especially around those battle cards. And then I wouldn't put like big stories on them. I wouldn't put things like that. I'd also put, you know, customer, either like customer benchmarks, like, or competitive, not competitive, sorry. I would put some sort of like, hey, companies this size, they really like to hear about this logo, or here's like a customer testimonial that, you know, you could kind of reference. But again, like it's all about cloning your customers. That's what it's all about. And so basically everything about those customers are really powerful.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the pieces, and I can't remember which blog post of yours it was, but it sort of talked about trying to figure out what the value of every, or trying to quantify the value to the customer of each feature, right? And I think one of the pieces that really unlocked for me in my brain was when customers are pushing back on price and you really understand what that sort of path to value is for them, it makes it so much easier as a sales rep to hold your ground and say, listen, no, I'm confident that we can produce, you know, X value in Y number of months. And that's why our price, we're firm on our price at Z. Because I think too many salespeople, they sort of just result to, okay, instead of holding firm and like knowing my product, knowing my customer really well, they just want to sort of take the easy way out and discount. And I'll hold my hand up and be the first person to admit that I've done this probably more than any. And it's only been recently, you know, the last 5 years that I've started sort of maturing in that way. And I've had some coaches and I've had some help and, you know, doing the research like this really sort of helped me understand, okay, well, if these are the types of features that the, you know, smaller companies are going to need because we've done this research. You know, these are the types of features that mid-sized companies are going to need. And this is the ones that the enterprises are going to need. Well, if you're claiming that you want the small, you know, the small price, but you need these big features, it's more information that tells me, okay, you're either not somebody that's going to close, or B, you're working for an organization and you like a larger organization and you're just on an exceptionally tight budget, or you're just trying to grind me down just for the sake of grinding me down. Because
totally.
we all get that a ton. And I find like having that information and understanding the sort of theory behind, you know, why, or understanding the reason behind why a certain feature is in a certain date was super helpful.
Yeah, 100%.
So I'm curious, you know, we're sort of talking about, you know, my journey as, you know, getting better at pricing. I'm wondering if you've got any opinion on what separates good salespeople from bad salespeople, or I'd say maybe high ARPU salespeople or low ARPU, so average revenue per user.
Yeah. I think, I think we talked a lot about it, right? Because I great salespeople, like I'll use like hammer scalpel metaphor, right? Which has been used plenty of times in the world. I think not great salespeople are like sledgehammers. They think they only have this brute fee get to their quota, which means dial for dollars, burn through leads, discount, all these things that just don't really work, right? They're TV or... Yeah, I think what separates great sales folks and you know, not so great sales folks is really kind of comes down to that metaphor of the sledgehammer versus the scalpel, right? I think not so great sales folks, what they end up doing is they just use the sledgehammer brute force. They burn through leads, they discount, you know, without even needing to, without even the, my favorite thing, I shouldn't say this because they're a customer now, but let's just say I called in for some support on a particular software product we use and literally just got on the phone. I didn't want to talk pricing or anything. We were already a customer and they were just like, yeah, do you want a discount? And I like that brash, they were just like, oh yeah, we offer like a discount. I was like, I didn't even ask about a discount. Like what's going on? I'll take it though. Right.
Yeah. I'm not going to say no.
Yeah. Like it's like that type of brute force. And I think that the best salespeople out there, they understand that their toolkit is so much more precise and so much better than just dialing for dollars and things like that. And they basically understand how to really evaluate a lead or a prospect. And then based on that evaluation, how to take those individuals to the next step. Now, I talked a lot about sales managers before because I think sales managers, they end up getting kind of the clay that they're given. Even sometimes, right? Like you do need bodies. And sometimes what ends up happening is you just kind of divert to, okay, here's the script, here's this, here's that. And that's great, you know, because that's how you sometimes build an efficient machine. But because of that, what you should be doing is basically focusing on, all right, how do I get maybe the brute force sales folks to follow the playbook or at least follow the rules of the playbook as what my best rep would be doing. And it's not as complicated. It's not as complicated because it's, you know, it's kind of like a tree of, you know, are they this? Cool, here. And yeah, there's gonna be like bugs. There's gonna be like 20% of people that just don't fit that rule book, but that's gonna probably improve the close rate and the close value even still.
I love the sort of the way we sort of framed up earlier when we were talking about the sort of the different gates and the different sort of the pains and the plans and all that. How do you, when you're engaging with a, you know, with somebody, let's just say you're helping another entrepreneur and they're asking, you know, help me, like my current price is just $49 or let's call it $5,000 a month. Right. And it's just one price. How do you take that from, okay, you know, let's break this down into multiple, or how do you understand, should we break it down, you know, to, so we're serving multiple personas and go from like, should it be one price? Should it be multiple prices? What are the sort of first steps in like narrowing down that pricing process?
Yeah. So single pricing is probably the worst. And a lot of people, they're like, well, it's simple. It's like, okay, like there, it's very rare you can pull that off. And if you are pulling it off, then you are giving something up. So Basecamp, you know, they're obviously a darling of kind of like the bootstrap of SaaS 1.0. They're still around, still, you know, printing cash, which is great. But they, in particular, they have one price point and they're definitely losing money, but it's better for them because of how they want to build their business. And for most folks, it's something where it goes back to those personas. So persona pricing fit basically means you want something for each of the personas that you're targeting. And for most of us just starting out, we probably don't want to target a ton of personas. We want to go after like maybe one functional type persona. So meaning we want to sell to salespeople or sell to marketers or sell to whomever. And then from there, we want to go to different sizes, right? And those are like, you could define personas as small salespeople, medium salespeople, big salespeople, right? And once you kind of get your mental mind, your mental framework around, okay, we're going to go after these types of personas, then those battle cards and those persona cards start to fill out, right? So if you're an entrepreneur coming to me and you have $50 a month and let's say you're targeting salespeople, and I'm like, okay, cool. So let's start. Like, what do you have? What kind of inbound interest do you have right now? Well, we got this one person who's an enterprise and they wanted, they would be 1,000 seats, but we don't have all these features. Okay. That's one persona. Then we have these folks who are kind of medium and then these folks who are small, just kind of continue the story. Then what I want to do is I want to go out and I want to talk to, on a qualitative basis, those three different types of personas, just to like 10 people. And I just want to ask them about, you know, what do you care about? Hey, we're building these five things. What's the most important feature out of those five things? What's the least important feature out of those five things? And that's actually a really good sales tactic too. Hey, we just talked about these like five features through this demo. What was the most interesting? What was the least interesting, right? It's a question that not a lot of people hear, but it also gets you information, right? And when you're doing this research, you can then kind of filter that down. And then I can also ask those folks around their willingness to pay. And if I'm talking to them on the phone or I'm talking to them in person, I'm not going to use all of these questions, or I'll tell you the ones that I would use. What I would say is something like, great, we just talked about this. It seems like interesting, you know, to you. Like, at what point would this be way too expensive? You know, you'd never consider purchasing it. You wouldn't return my call. And then they'll struggle with it. Not everyone will give you an answer, but they'll give you a lot of context. And then I follow that. Hey, at what point is it such a good deal? You sign the DocuSign today. And now all of a sudden with those like three questions, I start profile, right? And if I do that across 10 people, I start to figure out a lot of things. And then if I really am like trying to $1 million or $10 million decision, then I'm going to go out and do like a bigger survey that's more scalable to go get those folks back. But that's the type of research, and you can do that in your discovery calls. I do that in discovery calls all the time. Our team, our sales team does it all the time, just because it's powerful and it allows you to understand who that user is and what they care about.
That's amazing. So are you actually asking at what point does this become too expensive? At what point is this basically, you know, free in your eyes? Or are you asking the confirmation question, you know, which of these is your favorite basically, or how do you rate the importance?
Yeah. So it's both, right? So it's more like, it's kind of like, hey, we just did a demo. We talked about, you know, so we talked about analytics, our integrations, retain and this and that, like, what's the most interesting? What was the most important to you? What's like the least important? What do you like not really care about, right? And when I ask the pricing, and this is in like a sales conversation, I'm doing a customer development conversation, I feel like no problem ebbing and flowing between these questions, being a little bit more direct. In a sales conversation, normally what ends up happening is, you know, you get, oh, what's the pricing? What's this? What's that? And if it's one of our products, the natural question sometimes is like, oh, what's your budget? Right? You know, and then you get into the budget dance. Well, what's the price? Well, what's your budget? Right? Some people will tell you the budget, some people won't. And so to kind of cut through that, yeah, exactly. And so to kind of cut through that, it's like, okay, instead of being like, oh, what's your budget? It's just like, hey, let me ask you a question. So at what point is this like way too expensive, you know, but you never consider purchasing it? And sometimes they won't, they'll be like, I don't know, but my budget's this. Cool. Like, not only do I have, they have no context of how, you know, how like this should be priced, or no context on where the value is, but I just got the budget answer, right? Mm-hmm. And if I'm on, you know, more one of our scalable products, which has like super, it's straightforward, but it's a, like, meaning it, there's not a lot of negotiation with it because it's paid for performance. In that particular case, I go, okay, you know, they ask me what the pricing is, and I go, okay, just out of curiosity, at what point is this way too expensive? And they give me an answer. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to tell you the pricing, but that was really useful for me. Because then I know, like, if they go, oh, well, $50, I know that I'm way, way behind where they think the value is. Either they're a terrible lead, or I am not done my job to like really communicate the value. Mm-hmm. And then I want to, you know, maybe not even get into the pricing, and I want to like talk to them. Like, okay, hold on a second. So there's a big disconnect here. Just want to like talk through that, like, tell me a little bit more, like, and all of a sudden I'm getting a ton of information that allows us to basically, you know, basically move forward.
That's awesome. I love that you're sort of bringing some of these discovery questions, these like persona, like pricing discovery questions into the sales process. Yeah, I think one of the things that I didn't expect to help me with the sales process was learning more about product management. And I sort of view it all kind of in the same, it's all in the same family. And really, when you think about it, there's like, there's product management is what starts it all. And then pricing is the exercise you do next to figure out, okay, this is the value we're creating. This is how much that value is worth to the customers. And this is what we're going to charge. That's sort of working out the economic model of the price, or I'm sorry, of the product. And then sales is just the execution arm of those two exercises. And I think the
100%,
what I've seen more and more is just some product management questions sort of leaking into my sales conversation, you know, really drilling down on the value of what they do. Because one of the things we want to do is make sure our customers are super, super successful. And so trying to vet them and trying to understand and make sure that we're bringing really great customers to the team. But anyway, I'm going on a bit of a tangent, but it's just, it's always interesting how you learn about these other disciplines like pricing, like product management, and it starts to impact the way you communicate with customers and the questions you ask. You ever find that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, price is your exchange rate on the value that you provide, right? That's what you're doing. And so when you think about that mental model, it's all of a sudden it's cool. Okay. Well, I need to find the features that this person values.
Yeah.
We either have them or we don't, and they're just not great for us, or we have them and I have a bunch of others that I can talk about, but why don't I just talk about those, right? And that's where, again, even in product is all about value too. What's going to be valuable? And what's really funny is that our product leaders typically aren't building the features that our customers actually value. We have a bunch of data on this where basically we had product people put on this matrix on, you know, value of features, like what they thought the value of their products or the features were. And they all said, oh, they're really, really valuable. They're boosting willingness to pay, all that kind of fun stuff. And then we went out and we actually collected data from, I think it was like 1.5 million customers, and basically asked them, you know, using some of the methodologies we developed and the algorithms. And it was basically the polar opposite. So our product teams think that, because our product teams aren't even doing this research either. That's what's scary. No one in the organization is really doing this research. But the advantage is that sales folks, your literal job is just to talk to people on some capacity, right?
For sure.
And so you might as well just use these tools, and maybe they're not going to get back to, you know, the product or the pricing. But at the very least, you can just use them to do your job well and at least, you know, save you time and be a little bit more efficient.
You mentioned value metrics there. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. So a value metric is what you charge for. So it could be per user, per 100 visits, per, you know, per dollar saved, whatever it ends up being. And when you charge for those particular value metrics, the beauty of it is if you get your value metric right, basically it doesn't, like, if your customer sees the value similarly to you, there's no reason for them to churn. But also you can get your customers at different sizes, right? So one seat of Salesforce to a 5-person company doesn't seem like a lot of money, right? 500 seats of Salesforce to a large organization, it just kind of seems like the cost of doing business, right? But somehow Salesforce is able to get both of those customers because they have a value metric, right? And per user, I should say, it's typically not a great value metric for most of us. For folks like Salesforce or really any type of product where if I log in and you log in, we have two different experiences, and that's kind of what a CRM is like. But that's one of those things where, you know, it's super, super powerful to use that particular piece. And there's three big elements of a value metric. The first is it has to basically be as easy to understand as your sales process. So if you have, let's say, no salespeople, nothing to do with sales, then it's got to be simple because your salesperson, there's no salesperson to explain it. If you have a 7-call sales cycle or something like that, then it could be a little bit more complicated. It shouldn't be too complicated, but still you can kind of explain why you're pricing based on that value. Mm-hmm. It should grow with your customer's usage of that value. So as they're getting more value, they should be basically paying you more. And then finally, it essentially needs to be where the customer sees value in your product. So if they don't see value in per user, don't charge per user. And the best way you can do that is actually use some of those kind of methodologies we were talking about, which is, hey, these are 5 ways we could price. When it comes to our pricing, what's the most preferred way? Per user, per 100, blah, per 1,000, this. What's the least preferred way? And all of a sudden you have some data, and you can, with all this data, you can, you know, not make a decision off of it and say your customers are stupid. That's fine. It's your job to filter that data, but at least you do due diligence. So you know, all right, we're going to do the thing that they said they don't want. That's the uphill road we're going to kind of battle, essentially.
Awesome. Thanks for jumping in there. I know we've mentioned it maybe a couple times, and I just want to make sure that we're on the same page, because I think or at least just getting in depth so we can share that knowledge with the audience. I think having that sort of insight into why products are priced a certain way is massive.
Yeah,
I got two last questions for you, or one question, and then sort of the final segment here. But I mean, with all of this, like, it does seem like, you know, product sits here. Pricing is an extension, or at least should be an extension of that product process. And then sales is the execution arm. Why aren't salespeople more involved in the pricing conversation?
I got some real talk. I think sales folks have ruined their opportunity to be involved there.
Ooh.
Now they can get it back. And
gloves up.
I know I'll get a lot of downvotes for that one. But the issue is that you got to understand the past 10 to 15 years, it hasn't been easy. Nothing's ever easy, but it's been easier to be a salesperson. You know, leads would come in. You know, you have to do your job, and you have to push them there. And there's always bad prospects and huff prospects and all that kind of fun stuff. But at the end of the day, it's one of those things where it hasn't been, you know, there hasn't been a good forcing function to like make salespeople, you know, better salespeople, essentially. And that the reaction has been, you know, it's very rare. I mean, to have sales who's like, yeah, it's okay raising prices. No, prices need to stay the same or go lower, because they think that's what's going to cause them to not meet their quota and not meet their numbers. In reality, the actual answer is, well, we should price where the value of the product is. And that might be higher, that might be lower, but with a basic understanding of economics, you all of a sudden start to realize, well, maybe that means we're going to have to change the way we do sales if this is a more high touch or a more kind of high volume business, depending on kind of what the data says. But a salesperson, at least in my opinion, should always be open to, hey, the price should be where the value is, and we should be smart about this. We should do this, you know, somewhat intelligently. And then based on that, that allows us to, you know, do our jobs best, because then we're not trying to take bad leads and put them into a bad pricing, or good leads and put them into a bad pricing model. I will say that I always recommend sales being involved in pricing committees and pricing decisions. At the very least, you're on the front line, so you have so much context. But when you're at that table, you need to use that context for essentially bettering the company, not worrying about protecting your own dog bowl. And to be fair, I can say this about other parts of companies as well. But normally that's typically what we've met. And it's not the salespeople. Typically it's like sales leadership that kind of have this mindset.
Gotcha. It's that sort of fear, that resistance to change of, this is how we've been doing it. This is how I've modeled out to hit my quota this year. Any change to the pricing is basically going to take that precious spreadsheet, and just, I could potentially watch it crumble. Is the pressure that I think I could be on, that you would be under if you're a sales leader or even an individual contributor, right?
Well, I think the other thing too is that you have to understand that your product should always be getting better, right? That you trust your product team to do that, and you trust them to do their jobs. Price is the exchange rate and the value you're providing, right? So if your product's getting better, then your price should be improving. Maybe not always increasing, but it should be changing, because that value is changing. Now, if you're in like a perfectly competitive market, and your competitors are constantly adding the same amount of value as you are consistently, then it's a little bit of a different story. But overall, I think it's one of those things where you should be open to that change, because it's only going to help your team further. It's just exactly like you said, that kind of short-term anxiety, or that anxiety of, you know, what's going on with my number. And at the very least, you know, maybe you negotiate that, like, hey, I'm more than willing to test this, but you got to understand, I need some quota relief then to kind of, you know, make sure we test this out.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if it does go downhill, it is going to negatively impact. And I can't say all pricing changes are good. There's quite a bit of testing that you have to do. There's a lot of thought that goes into it. And so we can't just say carte blanche, all right, salespeople, listen to the pricing folks. They're going to make your life easier. But I think pointing out that there is that potential that when you do move from a pricing model that is, you know, outdated and you're not capturing all of the value, and moving to a newer pricing model, the amount of value that the company can capture is in some cases exponentially greater than what you had before. And as the frontline salesperson, you're the one that's, you know, primed to capture a good chunk of that value as well. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. It might be a challenging thing to sort of look at and rethink through how am I going to adjust this. But I think, you know, if your company's bringing in the right people and they've got a, you know, they're going to run some tests. I think thinking about the, you know, what is the long-term impact that this can have on me? You know, yes, it's natural to fear that commission check shrinking, but also think about that upside, right?
Yeah. I think ultimately it's also on the job of the non-sales execs and the non-sales teams to, exactly like you said, recognize, hey, this is like the biggest thing about pricing is people are just so scared to change anything because it's not something they know. It's not something they understand. It's not something they're used to doing. And so recognizing, hey, this could ultimately fail. And that's why you should also start small with the changes and don't try to change everything at once, which is kind of how people tend to approach pricing. But it's okay to fail, right? Like we fail in sales, we fail in product, we fail in marketing. It's okay to fail with your pricing. And if you do it right, you should hedge as much of that risk as possible. But recognizing that, I think you're exactly right, helps, you know, smooth some of that anxiety and smooth it amongst, like, you know, the rest of the army as well.
Mm-hmm. A random question I want to add in here. Who normally, like, if it's not the sales team that's working out the pricing, who do you usually talk to about changing pricing? Like, I've never heard of a chief pricing officer, although
no, they don't exist.
Maybe yeah. That's your future title.
No, I'm entrepreneur for now. Okay. Maybe when I retire, I think I'll get a job, but yeah, we'll see. So typically it's a cross-functional team. So we recommend, and it depends on your size, like a pricing committee typically should be made up of, you know, a head of sales, a head of finance, head of marketing, head of product. And normally kind of the leader or the main decision maker, if it's not the CEO, will probably be the head of product or the head of marketing. But like any cross-functional team, you shouldn't get to the end when a decision's being made without either everyone being on board, or at least everyone, you know, understanding and kind of disagreeing and commit, but having, you know, aired their grievance and, you know, have indicated what they want to look out for. So yeah, I think it's definitely cross-functional, but typically product and marketing kind of own it. The reason finance, you typically don't want to own it, is because finance is really good at creating models and spreadsheets, and that's great. The problem is their inputs aren't always great. So they're like, hey, we can, you know, be a $100 million company. Well, yeah, but you didn't test that our ARPU could be that size. So that average revenue per user, if it's half that, then we're not going to be a $100 million company, and all of a sudden our cost model goes out of control. So yeah, normally finance wants to be involved to do those models, but marketing and product typically kind of own that customer research. They're a little bit closer to that customer psyche. Mm-hmm. And they're not doing as many like functional things on a daily basis that sales is doing.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've worked for a number of companies, and I've never, as a salesperson, I've had a couple in, there've been a couple jobs where I was the one that was making up the price because I'm like, we can charge more for this. And then I'll make more money. You know, it's simple greed. And then others where pricing is set by somebody in head office 1,000 kilometers away or miles away.
You know? Yeah. Well, and when you put pricing out, or when you're about to change pricing, that's a whole nother conversation for us. But like, you got to make sure you don't just go, it's like a lot of big decisions at a company. You don't just go, hey, we're doing this. You roll it out, you make sure you get buy-in, all those types of things. You handle objections, you know, air the grievances, all that kind of stuff. Just to make sure that, you know, you don't have anarchy, or you don't have a revolution on your hands.
So you don't just change it on a call with a customer midstream?
No. That'd be a bad thing. Depend. If that's in your purview, if you have a rate card, yeah, you can do that. But yeah, you probably should do it a little bit more, you know, methodically than that.
That's fair. I'm not going to, I won't say who did that, but I'm very close to somebody that, that may have done that a couple of times, probably more than I'd like to admit. Yeah. All right, man. I really appreciate you coming on. I got one last opportunity to for you to sort of pitch ProfitWell. I almost said Price Intelligence there, but
okay. Yeah, we're still going to maintain that sub brand. There's no good articles written on how to change a name.
No.
So yeah, so, ProfitWell. Explain.
But no. Oh. So this is the fun part for me.
I thought this was the pitch part. Sorry, no. I'm not going to even pitch that bad. I'm just going to explain what we do. Sorry.
That's okay. So because it's a podcast about sales and it's salespeople on the other end, we're going to do cold call me.
Okay.
We'll do some role playing. So my phone's going to ring. You'll answer, and you're cold calling me. I'm going to try to throw some objections at you, but
oh no.
Yeah. So I got some real mean ones coming up. So be feared.
Okay. All right.
When was the last time you cold called?
Oh my God. It was a long time ago. It was before. Oh man. Okay. All right. I have to remember like my training on like how to start the I'm not worried about like the meat of the conversation. I'm worried about like the whole, like I'm going to do, and I'm going to get made fun of by all of your really good salespeople on the phone who are like, yeah, why would you start a cold call that way? Yeah.
All right. Well, we can break it down. If you're stumbling, we can pause and I can jump in and give you some tweaks, and then we can just sort of resume.
Yeah, totally. So what am I selling, or what's the deal?
Whatever you want, whatever that's, ProfitWell, whatever you want.
I kind of want to do like the Michael Scott. I don't know if you watch The Office, but like his children are not, what was it? His children are not, there you go.
So but I recently hit 6 years as an entrepreneur, and the team made that for me. And awesome. So it's, you miss, for those that are listening, it's you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, Wayne Gretzky, and then Michael Scott. And then they added my name underneath, Colin Stewart.
That's awesome. I love that.
Big hockey fan and big Office fan.
That's great.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
You're gonna do ProfitWell? You're gonna do?
Let's do retain.
Retain. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Ring ring. I'll be CEO. Who's your typical buyer?
Let's do customer success.
Customer success. Okay. Perfect.
And I'm calling you direct.
Yeah,
like I don't have a meeting. I'm just like,
you don't know me. You came to my name on a list in LinkedIn. You're like, I'm going to find this guy's phone number and give him a call. I don't know how you got my cell phone number, but let's just pretend that makes sense.
Oh no. Let me think of my first line. That's where I'm having the most anxiety. Hey, Colin.
So start with hi.
Start with hi. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go.
Ring, ring. Hello, this is Colin.
Hey, Colin, it's Patrick here. Do you have a moment to chat?
I got 30 seconds. I'm just heading into a meeting.
You got 30 seconds. Awesome. Well, Patrick, I'm from ProfitWell, and I just want to talk a little bit about your churn and basically how we help folks with their churn. So I know you only have 30 seconds now, but we're typically...
I'm in customer success. We actually don't churn any customers.
You don't churn any customers?
Well, not many.
Not many. Okay. Well, we typically find that most companies, they're churning about, 20 to 40%, mainly because of delinquencies. And that's really what we solve with credit cards.
20 to 40% churn off of delinquencies. So people just old credit cards?
Yep. Credit cards, they typically fail. I mean, they're not as futuristic as a lot of us thought they were, because they were built back 30 years ago. And so we understand credit cards and credit card delinquencies better than anyone else. And we basically solve that problem. And there's no work on your part. You just plug it into your billing system and go. But I know you only got 30 seconds, so I don't want to get too far.
I already have a billing system. We already use Chargeify. And it has recurring delinquency something or other that, when a credit card goes out of expires, then it tries to figure that out for them.
No, that's awesome. We're not a billing system. We integrate with Chargeify. So we actually know Chargeify really well. They're partners of us, and we actually, our recovery rate's actually probably about 2.5x their average. So we're recovering about 75%. You're probably only really recovering about 25, 30% right now.
Hmm.
Oh, the silence game.
I'm just killing you here. I think people listening to the podcast, I'd love your opinion. Where should he take this call now? I think I probably would have flipped that back on him and say, hey, do you know what your recovery rate is? And then really drill in on that pain, right? Because if the goal is to, right, the goal is to create, to find something that's enough interest. And this is something that's going to help capture 20 to 40% of my customers that I'm losing. I'd say, hey, do you know that? Right? Do you know your recovery rate?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you actually based on this. So we don't do any cold calling.
Okay.
I don't know. I think like there's value. I know there's value in it, but we follow like a pure inbound model. We do a lot of our objection handling, you know, via email, and we're probably missing, you know, the customer success guy or gal who, you know, doesn't want to look at our emails or anything like that. Like, what do you think of that? Like, should we add cold calling? Like, is that something that we should do? Or is it something where it's like, yeah, just keep doing the inbound model?
So I've done a ton of cold calling. I love cold calling. It still works. It's not going anywhere. I think there are smart ways to do cold calling, and I think there are not smart ways to do cold calling. I think we basically, predictable revenue, we get companies that have read the book. They're like, hey, we want to grow. We want to do outbound. If you're listening to this, you probably already know all this. But what we see a lot is with companies that sort of hit, you know, it can be $2 million, it can be $10 million. We've seen companies that hit $30, $50 million, and all of their revenue to date has come from founder network or from inbound. And eventually, almost every company, I would say every company that we've worked with has sort of hit this plateau from inbound. And I'd say, I think one of the best examples was Acquia. And they're doing, I think they're public now. They're probably doing around, I Googled it the other day, and they're doing around $130 million last year. Yeah. And they were, when we first talked to them, this is must have been 10 years ago, they were 100% inbound. And I had Mike Stankus, their VP of sales, on the podcast. He's actually gone on to the BCRO at a different company now. I'm drawing a blank on that company. Sorry, Mike. But basically, he was telling me, if you look up his podcast, we did it last year. We talk a little bit about this, that he was initially skeptical because he's saying, you know, look at our CAC on inbound. We get such great numbers. It's so predictable. We do X, Y, Z, and you know, the inbound fills up. And I'm gonna guess they're probably around $10 or $20 million at this stage. I don't actually know that. I wasn't part of the deal, but I'm gonna guess that's roughly where they were, just based on the structure of their team. And when I talked to Mike last year, so this is end of last year, over 95% of their business was coming from outbound. And what he had said was, you know, not only did inbound plateau at a certain point, because there's only so many, there's new channels, but like you said, there's no new Google, Facebook, Twitter popping up every year like it used to be. And so as those channels became more and more saturated, became more and more expensive to compete over those dollars. But the one thing that didn't change was outbound. Right. And since then, it's been the consistent driver of net new logos year over year, and to the point where he admitted that, you know, had they not pursued an outbound strategy, they might not be around still, or certainly would be sort of a shell of what they're currently doing now. Because you think 95% of, you know, $130 million is, you know,
yeah, not
pretty small amount.
Not too shabby.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things where we're probably still in, you know, that hasn't plateaued yet stage. I know we've talked about it. We have some reps who, and some AEs that, you know, have come from that environment, and it's not, I don't have anything necessarily philosophically against it. It's more of just, hey, if this works, you know, but that's probably not a good argument. I don't know. It's something interesting. Yeah.
There's no right answer. I think it depends on the size and where you're at as a company and what you can afford time-wise, right? Time and focus. I think I'm a big fan of finding one channel, maxing it out, growing it, doubling down
totally.
until you're starting to see diminishing returns. Once you start to see diminishing returns and you're saying, hey, this isn't going to help me sort of hit that next growth step or that trajectory, or like we're doing our forecast for next year. And if I look at what our forecast would be with inbound alone, and then I look at, okay, well, actually we want to ratchet that up $1.5 million, $2 million. And for me, because we've got sort of a proven model in place, it's like, great, we just expand the SDR team, right? Yeah. Because I know an SDR is going to bring a deal, two deals a month, you know, over time.
That's
and we
I
just, you yeah. do that math. I treat it just like a, just like you would inbound, just like you would a specific channel. But I got to say, I love the reliability of it. When, but again, it takes quite a bit of effort. You need a, you know, you need somebody whose full-time focus it is.
Yeah.
It's hard to, it's one of the things that a lot of companies and podcast listeners, sorry if you've heard this already, but it's one of the things that a lot of, we find a lot of companies try and do off the side of their desk. You've got an account exec, you've got an inbound person, you say, okay, I want you to do outbound, right? We're doing mm-hmm. this to a, one of our guys right now, but not, not on a full-time basis, just because we want them to learn. But doing inbound and outbound is one of the hardest things, because with inbound, you're, it's like sitting on this soft and cushy couch, right? You're sitting there and leads are coming to you. People are coming to sit down on that couch because it's a comfy couch. And they're like, oh, man, my feet are tired. I want to sit on this couch. Versus, you know, outbound is more like, I don't know, trying to pick somebody up on a bicycle and to like, hey, you want to come double Dutch or Dutch on my bicycle. It's less comfortable. They may, their legs might not be tired. This is a terrible analogy. I'm aware of that.
I'm okay with it.
And you have to drive around and go try and find them. So it's two totally different mindsets, riding a bicycle, sitting on a couch, right? And it's hard to be very good at both of them. And the context switching that you need to do just makes it nearly impossible to be really, really great at both of them at the same time. And so if inbound is helping you guys hit the growth rate that you want, then inbound is great for you right now. I imagine it might get to a certain stage, you know, whether it's the $10 million, $20 million, $30 million sort of level where, you know, inbound starts to slow down, or you get to be so large that inbound is still contributing, you know, the same number of leads, but in order to hit that, that higher, faster growth rate, you need to bring in more sales every month. And that's where outbound can be really helpful. The one thing I personally like it, I like about it is that you get to choose your customers. You get to go from product and say, okay, these are the ideal customers. And then you get to go, all right, let's go into, you know, my list building tool and let's build the list of these customers. And hopefully these filters that I chose represent them. And then I can basically pick my customers, you know, and
cool.
It's a bit more complicated than that, but
sure.
That's one of the things that I love about outbound. And traditionally it's helped us find larger deals. Because outbound is expensive, you know, in some cases it can be more expensive. It can be longer to get the return on than inbound. But I think it depends on where you're at it as a company. I'll step down off my soapbox.
No, that was great. That was good context. I think it's just, yeah, it's one of those things where it's similar to people who say, oh, we're never going to raise prices on our existing customers. It's like, well, once you reach 10 million, you're going to have to at some point just because of math, right? And I think that's kind of with outbound, like eventually you're going to have to do something similar to that. We do a little bit, we do calls. We typically don't, normally there's a lot of context why we're calling. It's not like a straight cold, but yeah, it's something that we'll probably have to expand to.
Cool.
Next time we'll do an inbound call, meaning a demo. And then I will crush that. I'm great at that.
Awesome. Right on, Patrick. Well, man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate the little diversion into, you know, why outbound. I think that was a nice way to wrap this up.
Awesome, man.
All right. Thanks again, bud.
Yeah, I'll see you.